2 weeks of the 3 week trip there with Brother Bob Buchanan and two other men as we went to some of the locations in the Philippines preaching and encouraging the brothers and sisters that were there. Now, I had slides and pictures and maps and all kinds of fun stuff. What I apparently do not have is a connection that will hook up to this projector or a functional zip drive that will allow me to copy the files over to Don's laptop. So what you're going to get is an oral account, and I will try to be visual if I can. We'll see how this goes. Fortunately, Julia's been there, so she'll at least know what I'm talking about. The rest of you maybe not. But I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that, and I'm appreciative for Don and JD to give me the opportunity to do that. Acts 14 talks about how Paul and Barnabas came back together with the saints in Antioch and talked about their experiences and explained what the Lord was doing with them and their works. And I think it's a good thing for us to do from time to time, to talk about what's going on in the Lord's work overseas, some of the successes and also some of the challenges. So we're going to do that for a few minutes. If we have time, I'm glad to answer questions. If we have time, I suspect that we will, because my presentation just got a lot shorter. But that's okay. Just to give you a quick overview, the team spent about 3 weeks in the Philippines. I was there for two of them. I get about 18 days off vacation, which is a lot. But when you factor in vacation time and then 2 weeks of time in the Philippines, it just doesn't leave a lot. So I'm not able to stay for the full time. But we flew in as a group into Manila, and I learned something about faith. And I have a slide here that basically says, faith is getting on an airplane and going to a country where you do not speak the language, and you think that your interpreter and your guide is going to be there to meet you at the airport, but you don't really know. This was a trip that was a little bit different from our three previous ones. Bob Buchanan, who is the leader of this group, some of you may know Bob. He has been to the Philippines 27 times now. He's a preacher that lives in Bowling Green, Kentucky. He was a preacher at the East Side there for about East Side Church of Christ for about 19 years before he resigned his ministry and his eldership for the purpose of working full-time in the missionary fields. And so he's been doing that for a long time. And he goes to the Philippines every year. This year he went twice for a number of different reasons. So this was his second trip of the year. So he was already a little behind in trying to figure out how to put all that together. At the last minute, about a week before the trip, we got news that one of the preachers on the island of Mindoro, Alicio Sicat, had died. And I had some slides, and I wanted to talk a little bit about him. Just to sum up, here's a man who essentially was responsible for the church in Mindoro on the island. He had done a huge amount of work. He had been there for, I think he was in his 80s, I believe. I don't remember his exact age. Bob said that he had never been to the Philippines when Alicio was not waiting on the docks in Mindoro to pick him up. So it was a very difficult thing for that church there. It's a small group. It's mostly family, but they probably have about 20 or so members that come to the church in Aurora there. Many of them are family. And so, as you can imagine, when we were there and we spent time preaching, we talked a lot about overcoming difficulties, overcoming adversity, and the hope of heaven. So it was an encouraging time, but it was also kind of a sad time as well for a lot of reasons. But all that to say, we didn't actually have an agenda until about 2 days before our flight. And to make matters worse, Bob said, well, I'm not actually going to meet you in the United States. I'm going to hook up with you later on in the trip because he was serving as the sergeant-at-arms for the Rotary Club International Meeting in Korea. So we had had no notice of anything that was going on the trip up until about 2 weeks before, so I think a few people heard me say, well, I think we're going to, all I know is I have a ticket to go to the Philippines. Now, what happens when I get there, I don't really know. But I took it on faith that Bob was actually going to be there, and he was. So we made our trip. For those of you familiar with the islands of the Philippines, we went into Manila, and I'm going to try to visualize it up here, so just imagine that there's a map of the Philippines. We spent the first day in the city of Manila in a suburb, Navaltas, with the Cabot Bahayan Church of Christ. A man and woman named Jerry and Tess Torreja were our hosts. Jerry's one of the two elders at the church there. And they've always been great hosts for us. They put us up. they have a little room, kind of a bunkhouse in their house, which is actually one of the nicer houses in the Philippines. We were very spoiled while we were there. When you think about going to the Philippines, you obviously think about the abject poverty and the conditions that people live in. And I'll try to paint you a picture. I have photos of this, and you're welcome to look at them afterwards if you'd like to. The Church of Christ building is a two-story structure that has basically been constructed in stages. And it is right next to one of the canals that goes through the Philippines. Now, if you look out on this canal, the first time that you walk up to it, the first thing that you will notice is the smell. It smells like rotten eggs, basically through most of the city, because the water is polluted. It is filled with garbage, and it's basically, it's very difficult to even get close to it. That is right next to the building. Along the canal, you will see structures where people are living, and they are basically lean-to structures that are made out of tarps, old signs, pieces of pasteboard, cloths, basically anything that people can put together to create an existence. Some of them are people that attend the worship with us. A lot of the little kids come in. It's one of the difficult things about that trip is walking around the city and seeing the kids. Our tradition is to walk around the neighborhood the day that we get there so we can kind of wake up and get our land legs together. And the one thing that's always constant, there's always little kids out playing basketball, and every one of them wants their picture taken. Every one of them wants to say hi to the people that look kind of weird, and they've never seen anybody that's white before. And so they're very curious and they're very friendly. And what we found is that every night when we would drive back into the house, there would always be five or six little kids waiting there to say hi. And I'm pretty sure they were just hoping we'd give them candy, which a lot of times we did. So there was a lot of poverty, but you're struck by how there's still people managed to live their lives and be happy and be fulfilled in a lot of ways. But there's a lot of need there. So the Church of Christ building itself is right next to that. So we spent the first day, on Thursday we did lectures for eight lessons. It was all day on Thursday. And then we went on to a town called Calumpit, which if you look at the map, if Manila is here, Calumpit is kind of up in the country out here. It was literally country. You have roosters tied up out in the backyard. I'm not sure, but I suspect they may have been raised for fighting. I'm not positive about that, but they kind of look like they might have been. Philippines, cockfighting is still popular and legal. It's legal, right? In fact, when you drive around Mindoro, one of the striking things is you drive past a stadium. And I asked, well, what's going on there? And they said, well, that's where they have the cockfights. So it still goes on. So, but we went out and spent the day with Mel Calumpin, and I wish I had a picture. Mel has been the preacher there for some time, and he's in a wheelchair. He has had all kinds of health issues, but is still plugging along as the preacher there. We had dinner with his family, and then came back. It was actually I don't want to go too far down that road. So we spent one day in Calumpit, and we came back. And at that point, the next 2 days we spent in a town called Binyan. It was a larger congregation and one that was it probably had a pretty good amount of people. I would say for our Saturday lectures, we probably had about 40 people or so, 40 or 50, and that number was probably closer to 60 when we had our Sunday worship the next day. We had our first baptisms there. We had four people that were baptized into Christ. I suspect that they may have been waiting for us. I'm not sure. It wasn't the preaching, I don't think, that converted them. I think they were ready. One of the difficult things about these kinds of trips is you come in for 2 weeks and you preach, and you like to think that you make a difference, but the reality is that the preachers that are there having Bible studies and working in the community every day, they're the ones that are laying the groundwork, and basically we're there to encourage them and help them however we can. We provide lesson outlines if they want to. They usually ask for our lessons when we're done, which is great. And any Bible class materials that we can bring. I know Michelle was able to provide us with a number of different exercises for some of the kids' classes there. So there's a lot of things that we're able to supply there, but ultimately they're the ones that are really doing the work. And so we always kind of have to remind ourselves of that you know, they're very hospitable and they're very gracious for us. But at the end of the day, you know, there are Christians that are working every single day to make those churches grow. And it was a reminder for me. We spent time while I was there talking about the kingdom of heaven and how the kingdom of heaven grows. And the idea that it grows like in Matthew 13 where it talks about the parable of the leaven. You know, when you put out your leaven and you put out your bread, for those of you who have baked, I have not baked, but I've been told by people who have baked, that when you put it out, you don't just stand there and watch it and wait for it to grow and look at it and go, well, wait a second, nothing's doing anything, so you just throw it out because it's not working. Well, you take it and you put it on the counter and you leave it for a few hours and you come back and all of a sudden it's become much bigger. And Jesus said that's what the kingdom of heaven is going to be like. It's not going to grow quickly, but it's going to grow steadily. And it's not going to grow steadily necessarily because of the work that you, as you talk to the disciples, it's not going to grow because you're sitting there tending it and toiling on it and working on it. It's going to grow because of the character of the people within the kingdom who are working and influencing and causing growth within that body. So when we see that growth, and the reminder that I had was that when we think about our growth here, and we think about what it means to make this group grow, you know, it's not going to happen because Don and JD are having Bible classes with people. It's not going to happen because we have good teaching, good sermons on Sunday morning. It's not going to happen because we have orderlies. Now, all those things are great, but the church is going to grow because we are teaching the gospel in our daily lives. We are doing the work. We are a part of the body of Christ, as Ephesians 4 talks about. We are doing the things which every joint supplies to the nourishment and the building up of the body together in Christ. So that's my side sermon. That was one of the things we talked about, so you got a little bonus points there. So we spent 2 days in Binyon. While we were there, we were able to do some health-related things. Bob, as I mentioned, is a Rotarian. And he was able to get funds from them and also from Christians in other areas to do a health clinic and an immunization session after the Sunday service. So basically we had kids from the neighborhood coming in and even adults as well getting malaria and I think it was pneumonia vaccinations and other checkups and all kinds of different medical things, which was good. And I wish I could show you the pictures of all the kids lining up to show you their shot and their little immunization badge. They were very excited about it. But so there was some good work that we were able to do there as well. It was not related to the teaching of the gospel, but it was something that still is greatly needed. And Bob was able to do that. And I mentioned Jerry and Tess, who kept us up in Cabot Bahian. Tess drove down. It was probably about an hour drive from where they live to the Binyon Church, and she came down and actually did the clinic herself. She's a physician. They call her nickname is Doctoro, and basically she's the one to call when anybody gets sick. Anybody in the Philippines that's a member of the church calls her and asks, "Can you get me drugs? Can you get me medicine? What do I do? How do I treat this?" And she is absolutely one of the best people I've ever met. Because she deals with the fact that she has to feed her family and she has to run her clinic, but she has brothers and sisters that need medicine that can't pay for it. And so she has to make that decision on a daily basis. It's something that we tend to take for granted. And I'm all over the place because my notes are obviously here and you can't see them anyway, so it doesn't matter. But I'm going to digress to tell you a story. I mentioned that Eliseo Sicot, the preacher in Mindoro, had died about 2 weeks before we got there. The reason that he died, and I don't remember the details, but he had a stroke on the island of Mindoro. And his family took him to the hospital. He lives, his youngest daughter and her husband and their children live with them. Took him to the hospital in Mindoro, and the first question they asked is, "Do you have any money?" Their answer was, "No, we don't." And the response is, "Well, then go on home, because we can't do anything for you." So he sat getting sicker and sicker and becoming infected and suffering from organ failure for a couple of days because he didn't want to call Tess and ask her for help because he didn't want to be a bother. He did not want to be an inconvenience. He was basically ready to just die. And it wasn't until it was really too late that the family finally was convinced to call Tess, and they got him on the ferry and took him up to Manila and tried to treat him as best they could, but at that point it was too late, and again, He could have stayed in the hospital for a protracted time and got treatment, but again, it cost money. And Eliseo said, no, I'm just going to go home. So he went home and died. What made it even almost insult to injury is that while I was there, the funeral was scheduled. It was scheduled for a Wednesday after we were on Mindoro. I have a picture of the burial plot on Mindoro where there's a plaque, but they did the services in Manila. And basically, the funeral home works pretty much like the hospital does. You get there and they say, well, do you have any money? And if you say no, they say, well, then that's where it sits. And it's going to sit there until you can pay for it. So all the time that we were going on and doing our work and traveling, there was a behind-the-scenes work to try to figure out a way to get money for Esther, who is one of Alicia's daughters, to take first thing in the morning, get on the earliest ferry, go up to Manila, meet her brother in Manila, hand him money so he could get on hire a vehicle to drive him to the funeral home in time before it would close, at which point the funeral would have been canceled. They were able to do that, fortunately. Bob was able to give her some money. But it was a reminder of things that we just take for granted that just happened. You know, we just assume, well, okay, my relative has died. We'll have a funeral. We'll have the arrangements, and we'll do it. In Manila, in the Philippines, it's just not that simple. And unfortunately, money becomes a looming factor over basically everything they do in their lives. So to go back to Mindoro, after our Sunday service in Binyon, we took the ferry down. Actually, the team took the ferry down to Calapan, which is one of the port cities on the island of Mindoro. I took actually a day off. Bob was gracious enough to allow me to go diving one day. So I went to Puerto Galero, which is over on another part of Mindoro down here. Again, I have all these pictures, and it would look great, but you're not going to see them unless you want to come see them afterwards. But I've got time to tell this story. Puerto Galero is kind of up here on the coast, and the road to get to the bus that will go down to Aurora, where we were staying, you have to basically wind up the mountain. There's a big mountain range that divides the island in two. And there's really only one way to get from point A to point B, and that's either to go all the way around on a ferry or to take this one road that kind of goes like this and up the mountain and winding around and then comes down the other side and eventually gets there. Now, there aren't buses that make that road. Basically, I ended up driving on the back of a motorcycle that we rented. I suspect for about four times what I should have had to pay for it, but that's the way it worked. I got some amazing views, and I couldn't take any pictures because I was busy holding on for dear life to the motorcycle so that I wouldn't fall off. But it was an amazing view. And I was able to get back in time for evening services on Monday night, and we did more lessons there. We went on to Victoria from there, which is a even smaller town. I wish I could show you the pictures. It's basically a small shack, well, not shack, but it's a small structure with concrete walls up to about here and then wood grating and a wood-paneled roof, which was good because it was probably about 100 degrees and you could actually get air flowing through it, so that was nice. And we had people seated outside to look in because not everybody could fit in the building. We didn't have any baptisms on Victoria. We did have three on Mindoro in total. But it was encouraging to see one of the men that we baptized last year that was back and attending at Victoria. So we're seeing people that are baptized that are actually staying with the church, which was encouraging to see. So on Wednesday morning, and this is what I really wish I could show you, we took the ferry back. We had to be in Calambang. Is it Calambang? Which is about an hour and a half north of the ferry back on the main island. So we had to get up at 3 a.m. to jump on a ferry at 4 a.m. to take us up to the main island and drive and preach in Calambang. We were rewarded with some of the most amazing sunrises that you'd ever see, none of which you will see, but that's blame technology. It's not my fault. We were able to get in and do a couple more lessons in Calambang and then go back to Cabo Bahia. If it seems like we're just basically going from town to town, that's exactly what we were doing. Everything kind of blurs together at some point. But there's talk in the next couple of years, and I hope that it happens, of actually having a preacher training class that is in a central area where the preachers are able to spend time to raise money in advance so that they can come in and stay. And that rather than us going from city to city and spending probably more time on the road than we actually do teaching, we would be able to spend a good 2 weeks actually teaching classes all day long. I'm hoping that that will be the case. But as it was, we spent probably more time in a jeepney or on a ferry or on the back of motorcycles than we actually did teaching. But the experience that I had that was the most interesting and probably the most rewarding was when we went to the deaf-mute congregation. This is a group of about, by the time we were filled up, there were probably about two-thirds of the number of people here in a room that was probably about as big as these seats here. We had a small table. It's about this size, crammed into a room that was probably about from there to here. And we had a screen where they'd basically taken a sheet and pinned it up to the wall. But no one could talk and no one can hear. And Bob explained that, well, what you're going to have to do is create slides that spell everything out that you want to say, and they'll read it, and when they're done, they'll tell you, and you'll flip over the next slide. It is a very different way of preaching. Basically, the good thing was that we had a pointer, and so you're able to, if you wanted to emphasize a point, you would basically go down the line, tap on something you wanted them to read, and when you would look, and you would look back to them and ask, and they would say yes if they're ready to move on. And if any of you have ever, many of you have probably stood up and preached or even just talked to a group in some tech, and you probably sit there and look out and you wonder, is anybody even really listening or paying attention? And somebody's checking their phone or somebody's looking and doing this. And some people may be listening, but they're kind of looking off. And I have never, ever, ever preached to a group that was so visibly dialed into what you were saying. Not only because they had to watch, because otherwise they wouldn't know what was going on, but they were constantly signing back to you, either yes or affirming what you were saying or agreeing with what you were saying. And then there were obviously, you know, you assume that everybody can read English, but a number of them couldn't read English. And so there were some of the brothers or sisters were signing to the different people interpreting the slides. So it was one of the most chaotic scenes that you're ever going to see. You look back after you've been looking at the sign and you see people gesturing and making signs and doing all this other stuff. But it was extremely rewarding because you knew that they were paying attention and they greatly appreciated us being there. We baptized four people there. Again, I'm not convinced that they weren't being held for us, but they were baptized. And it was probably the most interesting thing that happened to us while we were there, because one of the women, let me back up a second. If you ever talk to anybody about baptism and explain why it's important, and if you talk to somebody in the world, one of the first things that they'll probably say is, well, yeah, but what about this person over here that can't get into water? What are you going to do about that? And you say, well, that's just, you know, you're just making that up. What if they just can't be brought into the water and it's like it's a health reason or something like that? And you say, well, that's just ridiculous. The Philippines presents some unique obstacles. As we mentioned, the deaf-mute congregation, which is in one of the suburbs of Manila. So you've got access to water, but as we talked about, it's filled with junk and it smells like rotten eggs. And if you swim in it, you're very likely to get an infection of some kind and you might even die. So baptizing somebody in that canal is not an option. There's not a whole lot of people that have bathtubs, so that's not an option. So what you're essentially a lot of times left with is either if there's a member of the church who is very wealthy and has access to a gated community with a swimming pool, which was the case in Binyan, or you go to one of the local swimming clubs and rent out the pool, which is what we had to do. We went to the swimming pool. We had to pay for all of us who came into the structure, and then we had to pay an extra fee for the people that were actually going to go down into the water. So everything comes back to having money. Unfortunately, we were able to do that. And it's you start running into a situation where there are very real barriers that people have to overcome. One of the ladies had an even stronger barrier, which was that she was afraid of water. And we didn't know that until we actually got there. We took the confession. I wish I had the picture, because it's Scott, the youngest person that was with us, was doing the baptisms. And so he accepted the confession by way of an interpreter who signed the words, and they signed back. I asked Bob if that was qualified as a signed confession. I don't think he really got the joke. And most people don't, but that's okay. It's just my humor. But after the first person was baptized, this woman started to get very agitated, and she started to feel sick. And the next thing we knew, she was standing over by one of the fences vomiting because she was so afraid of going in the water. And it became so intense that her nose started to bleed. And the other two were baptized, and then her family and friends spent the next probably 15 to 20 minutes trying to calm her down and trying to help her. In the meantime, Bob told me later, he's thinking, you know, if the pool minister ever, or the pool administrator ever saw what was going on over here, there's no way he would have let us into that pool. And we would have wasted this money, or well, we wouldn't have wasted. Three would have been baptized, but she would not have been allowed in the pool. By the grace of God, he did not see it. And once they were able to calm her down, they literally poured cold water over her head to try to calm her down. And she tried once and couldn't bring herself to do it and had to come back. But the second time, she said, no, I need to do this. And so they got her into the water, and it was hard to get her to let go of the rails, but she did. And it was hard to actually get her all the way into the water, but she did. And she became a Christian. It was very encouraging because we live in a society, and we have this conversation over and over, where all people want to do is make excuses for why I shouldn't be baptized into Christ, or why I can't be baptized into Christ, or why it's not that important for me to be baptized. But here was someone who was willing to overcome physical distress in order to do what the Lord wanted her to do. And so that was worth the trip right there to see that. So it was a good visit. It was also a visit that reminded me a little bit of some of the issues, and this is one of the things that I wanted to talk about in kind of a closing remarks. But since I'm off my notes now, I'm just going to ramble around and talk about whatever I want to talk about. One of the things that I know all of us growing up in different churches, assuming most of us who have been members of churches who have done missionary work, we tend to know how it works, right? We'll have two or three or four missionaries that we support in different parts of the world. And once a quarter, a sheet will show up on our bulletin board. Greetings, brethren, from insert. We had a great quarter. We baptized four, you know, and it goes down the list. And that's really the extent that we know. We just kind of assume that everything's going along fine, and that, but we just don't know. Going to the Philippines and participating in that ministry reminded me of the responsibility that we have on our end when we support men in that field. Because it goes beyond just simply sending money into a black hole and hoping that it all gets used the right way. I'm not going to name names. There is a prominent, or at least used to be a relatively prominent preacher among Churches of Christ. He is on the board of directors of a religious books print store. He works regularly in the Philippines. And what he does a couple of different things. One, he goes to different congregations around the country and says, hey, look, I'm going to be going to the Philippines, and they need materials, they need Bibles, they need books, they need all these materials for classes. Please, if you'll give me your money, I'll go down there and I'll make sure that they get what they need. Well, that sounds great. And so we give him the money. So he goes back to his bookstore. He buys from himself at a profit to him. And I witnessed it firsthand. When we were at the deaf-mute congregation, I was looking down. There were a number of packets that they were giving away to some of the members. And one of the books that each of them got was A Truth in Life. We've probably all seen them, or most of us have seen them, A Truth in Life workbook. You know what I'm talking about? You remember those? Many of you probably have. Well, it was a teacher's edition. I thought, well, that's kind of odd. Because if you've ever looked at a teacher's edition, you'll know that it's completely useless without the student edition. It's not something you can study. It's just, how do you teach this lesson? I thought, well, okay, so maybe they're training them to be teachers. Well, the problem was that every one of them that was given one of these got a teacher's edition. And what had happened was, he basically bought old materials out of his store that weren't moving, took them around, took them to the congregation and said, here you go. Here's your materials. I've done the Lord's work. Never minding the fact that they were useless, never minding the fact that they had completely wasted money just simply to give them something that they would never be able to use. You see more and more the opportunities for graft and corruption in the missionary work. And you see that when we do not pay attention to where we send our money. And when we allow people without any kind of checks, without any kind of safeguards, without any kind of transparency, you see this kind of thing happen. And we saw it at churches throughout the Philippines. You would go to a church that had a stack of books that were just completely irrelevant to them and useless to them, but they were sitting there and they had materials. Never mind the fact that they weren't anything that could be used. The second thing that we saw, I've mentioned money and how big a problem it is, not just in the Philippines, but in any third world country you're going to go to. Everything revolves around whether I have the money to do something. We didn't have as many people this year, but every year we have probably anywhere from 2 or 3 to 7 or 8 different preachers who want to come with us to all the services wherever we go. But they don't have the money for the ferry or for the bus or for whatever transportation, even the gas money to drive their motorcycles to a certain location. And so it costs money to do that. And we help when we can, and we try to give the facilities to try to accommodate them. But money becomes such an important part of everything that they do that it starts to become a means to the end. We do question and answers at most of the places that we would go, and one of the men at the cabin behind stood up. He's one of the younger men, and said, and through an interpreter, said, I really want to preach the gospel. I want to be a gospel preacher. I want to do the Lord's work. Now, can you give me any advice on how I can get support financially so I can start doing that? Now, think about that logic for a minute, because it's not a logic that's unique to the Philippines. It's a logic that we see a lot of people even in the United States. I will go preach the word if I can find somebody to pay me to do it. That is sometimes the environment that happens, especially when young men see preachers who are going around getting support from other areas, and they see, well, this is a way that I can make a living. This is a way that I can make money. And so you get preachers that basically, their focus is on how can I get financial support? What do I need to teach to get financial support? Who do I need to agree with? Who do I need to get along with? Who do I need to appease in order to get financial support? It becomes a real issue. And the man that I had mentioned earlier also collects money for evangelism work to support preachers in the Philippines. And we know the biblical model that we read in Scripture, which is that individual churches send to a preacher in the field who does the work there. Well, what they do is, if these groups will send money to me, I then in turn will convey it to my people in the Philippines. He has 3 preachers that are kind of, I want to say report to them, not formally, but informally. He says, well, I'll give you the money and I will allow you to be in charge of who gets it. And as a result of that, you have a situation oftentimes in the Philippines where you've got 3 preachers that have money and a whole lot of preachers that don't. And so if I want to make money, I know who I need to go to. So when one of these preachers tells me, hey, I want you to do this or that, that's exactly what you do. And if one of those preachers says, I heard you were preaching about this and you need to stop doing that, then that's what you do, because he's the one that's paying your salary. It's another reason why we need to be very vigilant. You know, we are not in the position right now where we can support overseas missionaries. Lord willing, we will be one day. When we do that, these are things that we need to be vigilant about. We need to have an understanding of how our uses, our resources are being spent. If you're visiting with us today, and by the way, again, if I haven't said it before, you came in late, we're glad you're here. I'm not the preacher, by the way. I'm just reporting out on something that a trip that I made a couple weeks ago. But if you know, I would encourage you, if you worship at a place that does work with missionaries, don't just read the newsletter and just assume that everything's going great. Get to know these men. Get to know their families. Get to know the work that they are involved in and understand how they are using the money that you are sending them. You know, it's not judgmental, it's not legalistic, it's not mean to demand transparency of the money that you're giving to the Lord for the purpose of doing the Lord's work. Most of them will be more than happy to tell you. They'll tell you more than you want to know about all the things that they're doing. But it's important for us to have that understanding. Let's see, we've got about 5 minutes, and I'm trying to remember if there's anything else that I wanted to talk about. Does anyone have, you know, at the risk of really going crazy, does anybody have any questions or any specific thing that you want to know about the trip? Yes, Don.
I was curious about, you mentioned a little bit more on the kind of teaching that was done, like the lesson samples that you did or that the other guys did.
Yeah. let's see if I can find it, because I can't. Those of you who know, I have issues with short-term memory, and so I will not be able to tell you half the things that I just talked about in the last 10 minutes, but I can read off of it. No, I can't. I can tell you some of the things that I talked about. I did a lesson that I mentioned earlier, alluded to, on the kingdom of heaven in Matthew 13, talking about some of the parables and how they work together to give a picture of how the kingdom of heaven grows. I'll give you another little bonus points on this sermon, because we don't usually look at these parables all together as a whole. But when you look at them and think about Jesus talking to his disciples and explain to them what it's going to be like when he's gone, when you're out preaching about the kingdom of God, it's not going to be what you expect it to be, because you're still in this mindset that this is going to be this earthly kingdom, and the Jews are going to be elevated and restored to their prominence, and you're going to go out into the world and you're going to preach to these Jews, and you're going to expect everybody to be on board and ready to go. But the reality is that most of them are going to say no, and you need to be prepared for that. And so he talks about what it's going to be like to preach the gospel of the kingdom. We spent some time talking about that. I talked about the concept of knowledge and knowing God, and how that works with the concept of love. One of the things, this is the other thing I wanted to talk about. One of the things that you notice about the Philippine churches are they are very zealous for the truth. They want to serve God. They want to serve God the right way. They want to be scriptural. But with that often comes a zeal that is not able to discriminate between the things that we ought to be arguing about and the things that ought not to be divisive among us, and the things that just don't matter. There is sometimes a lack of skill. I don't know if it has to do with the Tagalog Bible translation or just a lack of understanding about how the English language is used. And I'll give you an example. Ephesians talks about the fact that there is one faith, one hope, one baptism. Some of the preachers in the Manila area have taken that to mean that that means that there is only one baptism, meaning you can only be baptized one time. So if you have been baptized as an infant, you cannot be rebaptized. If you were baptized but you didn't understand what you were doing and you just got wet, you can't be rebaptized. There is only one baptism, literally. That is an issue that is causing division among the brothers there, brothers and sisters there. They oftentimes are literal to a fault, and it becomes very difficult to have unity among some of the brothers and sisters there, because they're not skilled at handling the word. They're not mature. And that is something we talked about a little bit in terms of the importance not only of knowing God, but also the love that 1 Corinthians 13 talks about that comes out of knowing God, and the love that compels me to treat my brother and my sister with kindness and with respect, and with accommodation, as we can read about to the extent of 1 Corinthians, when it talks about the idea of not offending others' conscience and living for each other and not living in such a way that we're going to be divisive and at each other's throats all the time, but to live in peace with each other. That is a lesson that sometimes is very difficult for people who are immature in the faith but are still very zealous for teaching the truth. And frankly, it's a lesson that we need to hear in the United States as well, because we get caught up in those things too. We talked about, I did a lesson on the thief on the cross, which you guys have heard me talk about at communion at one point, I believe, for those of you who are here. There were a number of other different lessons, and I can give you a full list of them if anybody wants to see. But that was just some of the samples of some of the things that we talked about. Any other thoughts? We are just about out of time. Did you have any other questions or anything?
Yeah,
And again, I'm more than happy to answer after services or whenever. But anyway, thank you very much for your attention. I apologize for not foreseeing the technical issues, but hopefully this at least give you an idea. And if you want to come look at the slideshow on my laptop afterwards, you're more than welcome to do that. But yes. Took a while to figure out what that was talking about, but they have long memories about their history, and there is a lot of appreciation. So, but anyway, thank you very much. I apologize.